I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. ISIS released another horrifying video yesterday showing the beheading of American journalist Stephen Sadloff, who had disappeared last summer while covering the civil war in Syria. The masked figure in the video taunts President Obama, saying, "I'm back, Obama, because of your arrogant foreign policy towards the Islamic State." That's the name this terrorist organization gave itself. The British-sounding voice continues, "So just as your missiles continue to strike our people, our knife will continue to strike the necks of your people." This is essentially the same message that ISIS delivered last month when it beheaded James Foley. It's a vicious and well-funded terrorist organization that now controls parts of Syria and Iraq with designs on the region and perhaps even beyond. Today we look at the rise of ISIS and the challenges it poses to the region and to the United States. We have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studio is Trudy Rubin. She writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer, someone we call on pretty regularly to talk about this part of the world. And Trudy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us and joining us by telephone is Joshua Landis, Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. And Joshua Landis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for inviting me on, Marty.
Absolutely. Let me begin with you, if I could, Joshua. What do you think ISIS hopes to gain from posting this video?
They're trying to intimidate the United States, and this is what they've done successfully in the last year as they've built up to this state. For example, only about a month ago, a tribe near Deir ez-Zor, a city in this desert region of the Jazeera, of the eastern Syria, one tribe rose up against them and tried to resist them. They have killed reportedly 800 of the men of that tribe. They're setting an example for all the other tribes who have relented and, you know, kissed the hand of Baghdad in supplication and giving bay'ah, what's called bay'ah or allegiance, to ISIS. So their intimidation works with people who are weaker than them. The problem is, once you try to intimidate the United States, as we're seeing, people get mad, and of course we've got an air force, which they don't, and we're using it.
And we're certainly using it in parts of Iraq. Let me turn to you, Trudy, and Dexter Filkins had an interesting piece in The New Yorker where he's writing about ISIS, basically saying, forget the politics, forget their political message. These are people that like to kill other people. Do you think there's some truth to that?
Oh, certainly. You see it in the way they behave, but it's killing with a method. I mean, you can say the group may attract psychopaths, but it's psychopaths who believe that somehow what they're doing is following in a 7th century tradition of conquest, and the self-description by their leadership of them as a caliphate indicates that they want to pursue an aggressive, expansive territorial conquest, imitating the caliphs who followed Muhammad. But I do think it is also violence aimed at intimidation. And I think if there is one small crumb of something good, or I should say useful, that comes out of this terrible tragedy of the two beheadings of American journalists, it is that it will wake up, I believe, the U.S. public and the administration further to the fact that you can't simply say it's not our problem.
You think it is our problem, and I do want to get back to that. I wonder to you, Joshua Landis, is this also part of ISIS's propaganda campaign or even recruitment campaign to use these videos to get people to join the movement, so to speak?
Well, it is. I mean, part of the generalized, you know, if one wants to generalize, the Sunni world, who they're speaking to right now, feels very oppressed. And even though they're the majority in Syria, 70% are Sunni Arabs in Syria, they feel like a minority. They feel like the government, which is a Shiite, Alawite-dominated government, has mistreated them. And they feel the same way about the Iraqi government. So in a sense, there's two big Shiite governments, Baghdad, Damascus, that have them in a vice grips, that have been bombing Sunni cities and taking it to the Sunni, largely Sunni rebel movement, which has been fighting both Baghdad and Damascus. So they are feeling oppressed, and they're appealing to a wider Sunni audience that also feels that the United States has been persecuting Muslims in the war of terror, and Arabs in particular, by supporting Israel and so forth. So they're speaking out against this latent, not very latent,
right,
this anger against the West, anti-imperialism. And so that has sparked, I think, that is part of a recruitment process in Europe, in the United States, amongst Muslims more generally, who feel like the West has been pursuing a war against Islam.
But just picking up on that very quickly and going back to you, Joshua Landis, which is that ISIS has been killing Muslims. I mean, yes, they might be Shiites, but nonetheless, they're killing Muslims, not you know, they killed a couple of Americans, but mostly they've killed Muslims.
Yes, and they're saying they're doing that in a name. They're calling them Rafidin, as rejectors, and Arfad. They're calling them people who are unbelievers because they're fighting against the caliph. Now that they have announced the caliphate, they're saying that anybody who's against them is kuffar, is an unbeliever. And so they've divided the world into a very stark, either you're with us or you're against us. And so the Muslims who then fight against them are seen as being beyond the pale.
Trudy, go ahead. I know you want to add something.
Yes. I think Josh was talking about something very important, which is the disaffection of Sunnis, both in Syria and Iraq. But I think we always have to clarify when we're talking about ISIS's appeal to Sunnis. This was not what even religious Sunnis among the many tribal groups and urban groups who rose up against Saddam. This is not what they were looking for. And basically, you have had desperate young and older Sunnis funneled towards Islamism because it was the only place to get money and weapons, and that didn't even send them to ISIS. I recall about a year and a half ago, I was the last time I was actually in Syria, only about 15 miles across the border, at a camp, a training camp of a Islamist, rather nasty Islamist group called Sukkur al-Shams, but not al-Qaeda. And there were the usual bearded, with short pants and long tunics, but there were a lot of clean-shaven young men. And when I asked them, why are you here, they all said the same thing, because these groups are the ones that have the money and the guns, or because they are winning. So you have had young people pushed towards different degrees of Islamist groups because they had the money and the guns, and maybe because in the end they turned to God because nobody else they thought would help them. But still, ISIS was a minority group, and I think that their growth is a product both of intimidation, as Josh said, and nobody is coming to the rescue of these tribes, and desperation, because a lot of other groups see that they're not making headway, and now ISIS, with the help of military experts from the Iraqi Ba'athist Party, who joined on the Iraq side, they are able to capture huge stocks of weapons, and so now they're the winning force. They're seen, and so a lot of people are either driven in desperation towards them or terrified into giving obeisance to them.
Josh, do you think there's then a military solution to defeat ISIS? Is that possible?
Well, one can certainly kill a lot of ISIS people. The trouble is, let me not disagree with Trudy here, but try to, I think, fill out a picture. It's true that the West has not stepped in on the side of the more moderate rebels, but it's not as if there's been no assistance. The trouble is that the assistance to the Islamists that has helped them grow and made them stronger comes from the Gulf. It comes from the Islamic and Arab world, and it comes from jihadists, Muslims, around the world, from Chechnya and many other places. So they are getting help from Islamists. And that's because, in a sense, America has to decide, do we want to be the force of liberalism in the Middle East? Can we put our hand on the balance of power and ideological balance of power and be the voice of liberals and support the liberals with guns and training so that they can destroy and kill the Islamists. And we tried to do that in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and we spent trillions of dollars and much too much of our own people. And America got tired of trying to do this. The problem, it seems to me, instead of focusing on the West being reprobate for not fixing Middle Eastern problems, is that there is a problem in the Middle East, and that Muslims have to figure out what they want in the long run. Do they want to fund and give money to Islamist groups who are going to build a caliphate, or do they want to give money to people who are going to try to separate church from state? And so far, the answer has been Islamist groups. And we've seen this in Libya, we've seen this across the Middle East. And that's, you know, that's a dilemma. And if America wades in to this cultural problem, we end up with Shalabis. We end up supporting people that are seen as agents of the West by local powers. And we're constantly trying to hit, in a sense, a square peg into a round hole in the Middle East. And that's why I think President Obama has taken a very cautious approach to this and said, you know, if we're going to defeat ISIS, which we can certainly do, we've got to find a Sunni military and political elite that can replace it in these regions, that can bring justice to Sunnis, that can satisfy them. So we're not just, you know, constantly killing the earth and disturbing the status quo and bringing death to people. Otherwise, we'll just be seen, you know, as killers.
Trudy, you want to add something? I know.
Right. I more or less agree with Josh. I think the days of trying to help, quote, moderates, close quote, are over because the moderates have been crushed and destroyed. If for 30 seconds we roll back history, I do believe that back in 2012 there were a lot of defected military officers. I interviewed a lot of them in Syria on the border that we could have helped. And I think if we had substantially helped them and put the same pressure on the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, about sending money to Islamists that we are putting on now, we might have had a different situation. But we are where we are. And right now, countries like Saudi Arabia, the, quote, moderates that they're sending money to are Islamist groups. Mm-hmm. They're not as bad as Al-Qaeda, in theory, but their doctrine ain't great. They're just as eager to commit genocide against Shiites, Christians, etc. So I don't think there are moderates to help. But that doesn't lead me to believe that there is no military action that needs to be taken. A long time ago, Obama spoke of disrupting, degrading, and defeating Al-Qaeda. If you translate that now, forget defeating. We need to disrupt and degrade ISIS.
And I want to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with Trudy Rubin, worldview columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Also with us, Joshua Landis. He's associate professor and director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, talking about ISIS, what to do about ISIS. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Beck Institute for Cognitive Behavior Therapy supports WHYY and offers a research-based and compassionate treatment approach for clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bella Cynwyd. More information about the Beck Institute and CBT at beckinstitute.org.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. Richard Reed Perry of Arcade Fire fame joins me to talk about Music for Heart and Breath. This is his debut solo record, which uses the body as its muse. That's Richard Reed Perry coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. An author takes his dog on a road trip to bond and to find out why other Americans are so crazy about theirs.
We spoil our dogs. We hire animal communicators to try to better understand them. We do yoga with them. And they've really taken on this incredibly powerful role in many of our lives.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first ever Lincoln MKC with the all-new available 2.3-liter EcoBoost powertrain. for the power and poise to handle any driving situation. More available at Lincoln.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Trudy Rubin and Josh Landis about ISIS, what challenges it poses to the Middle East, also what options that the Obama administration may or may not be weighing as it deals with this extremist group that has set up and taken over parts of Syria and also parts of Iraq. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Trudy, you talk about degrading. I mean, maybe not defeating. Maybe you can't send in SEAL Team 6 and take out al-Baghdadi. But how do you degrade ISIS?
Well, we have two problems, one in Iraq and one in Syria. In Iraq, we have some ground forces, whether it's the Peshmerga or some units of Iraqi forces. But the heart of the problem is on the Syrian side. And if we start from the premise that right now the ground forces we'd like to have, which are Sunni tribes that may not really like ISIS but are intimidated or feel they have no option, right now we're not going to be able to win them over. They don't believe in us. We're not going to arm them. And we're not going to give them air support. But we have a problem because ISIS is not static. They have said they want to attack in Saudi Arabia, they want to attack in Jordan, and they want to attack in the United States. And so if they simply have carte blanche to sit there and nurture all these plans while welcoming 1,000 more troops, foreign fighters from abroad, then they will do what they say. And so when one talks about disrupt and degrade, I think that it means collecting by whatever means, technical or other, intelligence. And yes, if we had intelligence on leadership, but we certainly don't have it now. But if there are training camps, go after them. If there is movement on the ground, go after them. ISIS will adapt. They probably will try to pull into the cities. But you have to keep trying to think of methods to keep them off balance so they simply are not sitting there. And of course, the argument will be if we do that, they'll attack us. But I think we're already in that place now, that they're going to do that, if not immediately, then sooner or later. And even if we just bomb in Iraq, which we must, they're going to behead anybody they catch. So I don't think that's an argument not to strike.
Josh, let me quote something that actually John McCain and Lindsey Graham said in the New York Times, and sort of picking up on what Trudy just said. They write, but ultimately ISIS is a military force. It must be confronted militarily. Mr. Obama's begun to take military actions against ISIS in Iraq, but they have been tactical and reactive half measures. Continuing to confront ISIS in Iraq, but not in Syria, would be fighting with one hand and tie behind our back. We need a military plan to defeat ISIS wherever it is. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think we have to remember that ISIS is not a threat to the American mainland. Now, it could become one, but it is not today. They don't have the means of hurting us. They are a threat to both Syrians and Iraqis. The problem that we have is that this, you know, as I said in the beginning, this is a big Sunni region. And what we're doing is we're partnering with Kurds in the north of Iraq and Shiites in Baghdad to go and kill them. We're going to bomb them, and then the Shiites and Kurds come into these cities. Now, as long as the cities are dominated by Yazidis and Christians and others, that's fine. But once you have Kurds and Shiites occupying Sunni cities, it doesn't go well. And that's why there's been this uprising. So the answer, if we're going to have a military answer to this, and it looks like we are increasingly, we either have to sort of pull up our pants and say, you know, it's okay if Shiites and Kurds rule over Sunnis, no matter how harsh their rule is, and we're going to help them just beat down these people. Or you have to say, we're going to nation build, and we're going to create a Sunni state from the edge of Baghdad all the way over to Aleppo and perhaps the Mediterranean Sea, and we're going to divide Syria into two, one ruled by Assad and one ruled by Sunnis. And we're going to see this as the emerging of a nation based on sort of a religio-ethnic background of Sunnis. We don't want to do that. We're pledged to the national integrity of Syria and Iraq. But that means that we're pledged to Shiites dominating Sunnis. And we are saying we're going to build a new government in Baghdad that's based on power sharing. The thing is, we had 10 years to do that when we actually had power on the ground, and we failed. We can't do that in Damascus either. We don't have the means or the ability to do what we say we're going to do. Therefore, we're in a sense living a lie.
Hmm.
We're going to bomb these people without any way of replacing and providing just government that will make the people who are being governed feel like they have a share in it.
But Joshua, are you saying that essentially whatever we do is going to have all these unintended and probably negative consequences, and that's an argument to not do anything and let locals, in a sense, fight it out or figure it out?
Well, if we're going to do something, we have to know what we're getting into. And, you know, if Obama and the United States feels that it's in their national interest to build a nation from Baghdad to Aleppo that will satisfy Sunni interests and demands, and that we can find partners who will be pro-American, who will rule that, and that we're willing to spend 10 years or 20 years or whatever it takes, and the kind of money that it would take to help build an alternative government that would be just rather than ISIS that we see as unjust, and which is unjust, then we can do it. But if we're going to pretend that it's easy and it all it takes is bombing, we've got to be careful, because we're going to be bombing for a long time to come, and we have to make sure that American people are interested in doing that.
Well, Trudy, and just throwing in whatever lessons either learned or unlearned from the wars that we led in Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly as it relates to nation building, sure, we can bomb cities, but we don't do a very good job building nations, at least not yet.
Well, I don't think we're going to be bombing cities, per se. I'm not advocating taking on nation building. I mean, yes, in Iraq, there still is some possibility for U.S. mediation if we have, you know, more special forces in there in specific cases. I think we're dealing with a long transition period in which there are going to be big ungoverned territories that can be taken over by radical Islamists, especially ISIS. That's fact. If we could make it otherwise, I would say stay home. But we can't. So in Syria, we basically have a situation where Assad is going to, it appears, be ruling over a rump Syria. And there will be this vast Sunni wasteland where ISIS will be the strongest and perhaps the only force. And on the other side, a large segment of territory where ISIS also. People ultimately may get sick of ISIS. The dynamic may change. But I don't think we can organize that. The problem is, what do we do in the meantime to keep ISIS from planning attacks going into Saudi Arabia, Mecca, Medina, very dangerously in Jordan, fomenting unrest there, perhaps attacks on the monarchy? And to me, one of the great dangers is that you have other al-Qaeda groups pledging fealty to ISIS. You now have an ungoverned state totally in Libya, which is looking now for inspiration to ISIS, cooperation. And most dangerously, I think you have Taliban forces that are making gains in Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons, forces Taliban, which may well have penetrated their military. You have the U.S. pulling out of Afghanistan. ISIS will become a beacon for all of these. There will be cooperation. I don't think you can simply let it settle. So what I'm saying is, you have these facts on the ground, and you have to use strategic attacks, you know, not just bomb every day and night, but trying to keep ISIS off base, not allowing it to have a comfortable homeland in Syria, Iraq, where it can welcome foreign jihadis with foreign passports who train them to go home again and bomb, and plan bigger attacks.
But aren't countries like Saudi Arabia, certainly Iran has been taking on ISIS, but even countries like Saudi Arabia look as if they are, yes, maybe parts of the leadership there has been funding groups like ISIS, but don't they see ISIS as an essential threat to their their future, for instance?
Saudi Arabia sees ISIS as a threat, yes. I mean, they still have a school system that raises their kids to believe that their hardline brand of Islam is superior to everything and that Shiites are infidels. But they're scared of ISIS because ISIS threatens them. They're giving money to other Islamist groups who now fall under the rubric moderate in Syria. I don't think that's going to solve anything, but what Saudi Arabia can do is beginning to and should be done to do is provide the massive financing to take care of Syrian and Iraqi refugees who are a breeding ground for future terrorism if they don't have some hope for the future and are burdening the countries in which they now are seeking refuge.
And that's Trudy Rubin. She writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Also with us, Joshua Landis, associate professor and director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. And we asked both of them to join us in this hour of Radio Times, talking, of course, about the vicious and horrible acts by ISIS, the video yesterday posted by ISIS, the beheading of another American journalist, Stephen Sotloff. But ISIS has been terrorizing people in Syria and Iraq for some time now. The question is what to do about this group, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We want to hear from you. I do want to play something from President Obama's news conference last week, and he was asked about Syria and ISIS, and let's listen to some of his response.
We don't have a strategy yet. I think what I've seen in some of the news reports suggests that folks are getting a little further ahead of where we're at than we currently are. And I think that's not just my assessment, but the assessment of our military as well. We need to make sure that we've got clear plans, that we're developing them. At that point, I will consult with Congress and make sure that their voices are heard. But there's no point in me asking for action on the part of Congress before I know exactly what it is that is going to be required for us to get the job done.
Josh, the president was criticized by a lot of people for that statement, we don't have a strategy yet. He was, as I understand it, referring to Syria. Were those criticisms fair, unfair?
Well, I think that he's doing what Trudy is suggesting that he should do, which is to keep ISIS on its back foot, take away territories where there are lots of Shiites or Kurds, and he is attacking them. The problem is the region is so divided amongst Shiites and Sunnis that if we just jump in and take the war to the Sunnis, we're going to end up being on the side of one of these groups, which is what we don't want to be. We've sent John Kerry out to the region to try to build a coalition, and that means trying to get Iran and Saudi Arabia, who disagree, two powers, that Sunni, Shiite, who have been at the opposite ends of this struggle in the Middle East, exacerbating it, developing militias and paying for militias that are very sectarian. We have to find a way to bring them together. In the long run, that is the only thing that's going to stop this sort of race towards sectarianism and radicalization and begin to roll it back. So I think President Obama is looking for that strategy. He has a strategy in mind, and he's looking to find a local cooperation. He does not want the United States to be Mr. Fix-It in the Middle East that runs off and takes charge of these regions. He needs to get the Saudis and the Iranians and the local powers, Jordan, Israel, and so forth, on board in a local fix so that they can provide money and manpower and don't leave America way out on the gangplank without really a national mandate for doing the kind of long-term help to the region that it really needs.
Well, Trudy, I was thinking about this, which is that it's pretty clear that while he does use drones and he certainly has used airstrikes, that there is something of the reluctant warrior about President Obama. But if we're talking about ISIS, he seems to be up against a group of people that are entirely unreluctant, if I can say that. I mean, ready to behead people and to terrorize people, to take land, and frankly not care what the world thinks, because apparently most people hate ISIS. And this sort of, I guess, uneven, perhaps, perspective on conflict and even warfare.
Yeah, I think, you know, first of all, I think you're correct on that. There's no negotiating with ISIS unless you want to negotiate over paying them a ransom. So that's number one. But number two, if I could figure out what the local fix was, if I could figure out what John Kerry, and I've seen what he said he wants to do out in the region, but it's still pretty vague. He wrote an op-ed piece just a couple of days ago. If I could figure out what they thought this regional strategy was going to accomplish in the final analysis, I might think it had some legs. But frankly, Saudi Arabia and Iran, we are not going to get them to deal together. We don't have any relationship with Iran. The nuclear talks are not going great. They could break down in the next few months, which is another wild card in this whole equation. The Saudis are fed up with Obama, and they're not going to embrace the Iranians because he asks for it, nor would he ask for it. So I don't think that the sectarian fighting is going to stop because Kerry runs around the Middle East, even if he had more traction and Obama had more traction than they do. So we are stuck with a situation in which the Middle East is going to be in this awful transition to God knows what for some years. And it seems to me we have to think of it as if we're thinking of Northwest Pakistan. We didn't try to do nation building in Northwest Pakistan. We tried to disrupt a terrorist movement that was threatening us. We tried to do nation building in Afghanistan, and it failed. But the real problem was in Northwest Pakistan, where we couldn't go in there. So we just disrupted them. Now, we had more eyes on the ground there. It was possible to get some intelligence through Pakistani intelligence than we have now. That's something we have to work on. Some tribes might be willing to serve as our eyes and ears. I don't know. But I know that we can't just sit still, and I don't see the regional strategy that is going to really deal with this. We can get money for refugees. We can try to cut off money for terrorists. But ISIS has its own financial sources from selling oil, from banks that they have robbed. They are
from ransoms.
From ransoms. 125 million, Islamic groups have collected this, and ISIS has collected its own protection money. So I don't see how the strategy is going to deal with the immediate problem.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about ISIS, what to frankly do about ISIS, if anything. Trudy Rubin, worldview columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. By telephone, Joshua Landis, and again, associate professor, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. And again, we'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and we do want to hear from you. Perhaps you have some ideas about what to do about ISIS. We'd love to hear them. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
The 29th Annual Mushroom Festival supports WHYY Saturday, September 6th and Sunday, September 7th in Kennett Square, PA. Featuring cooking demonstrations by professional chefs, the Mushroom Appetizer Cook-Off, and a range of mushroom delicacies. This festival also features hundreds of vendors, an antique and classic car show, children's activities, the soup and wine event, and live music. More about the 29th Annual Mushroom Festival, September 6th and 7th at mushroomfestival.org.
On the next Fresh Air, with the campaign season officially underway, veteran media consultant Neil Oxman takes us inside the world of campaign advertising. He'll talk about responding to attack ads and how the flood of money since the Citizens United ruling has changed the business. He'll also play us some ads he thinks were particularly effective. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Putin's big chill threat on empty?
They can't make it cold, and they won't make it cold. There's no question of him cutting the flows. If he did that, he would be brought down within a week.
Russia's neighbors want to call Putin's bluff on shutting off energy during the Ukraine crisis, chilling in Estonia and looking for some reassurance from NATO. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and you probably know this by now. ISIS released a pretty horrifying video yesterday. It showed the beheading of another American journalist, Stephen Sotloff. He had been reporting from Syria until last summer when he disappeared. ISIS has taken control of large amounts of territory in Syria and in Iraq, using both terrorism and what appears to be their military superiority. The White House is working on a strategy to deal with this group whose stated goal is to establish a caliphate. We're talking about this unfolding crisis and the options facing the region and facing the United States with Joshua Landis and with Trudy Rubin. Josh, let me just go back to something Trudy mentioned, John Kerry, and again, I'll quote something from the New York Times. This is something he said about how to deal with ISIS, and the headline reads, "To defeat terror, we need the world's help." He writes, "Airstrikes alone won't defeat this enemy. A much fuller response is demanded from the world. We need to support Iraqi forces and moderate Syrian opposition who are facing ISIS on the front lines. We need to disrupt and degrade ISIS's capabilities and counter its extremist message in the media. We need to strengthen our own defenses and cooperation in protecting our people." All of that seems like it would take years if it would even work at all.
Yeah, well, that is the problem with developing a coalition. And I think, you know, last week, To underline the complications and America's sort of misgivings about working with allies in the region, is last week in Libya, the UAE, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia all sent bombers to go and degrade Islamist forces in Libya. The United States condemned this effort because evidently our allies had not told us what they were up to. Okay. And this underlines in many ways how we don't want our allies to act to degrade these people, and yet we do want them to act to degrade these people. We're not cooperating with the Saudis on Libya. We want them to cooperate with us in Iraq and Syria. We are out of sync with the regional needs, and part of that is because we don't trust our own allies. We don't really like our allies. We want democracy in the Middle East, but democracy has brought forward, in places like Egypt and others, Islamist groups like the Muslim Brotherhood. And then we have backed away from really supporting them and gone back to the military because we want stability, we want good relations with Israel, we want a whole package of things. So we've been caught, in a sense, in our own... We want things that are impossible for the region. We don't want Islamists, who are, by and large, quite popular in the Middle East. And we do want, you know, our allies to win, Saudi Arabia and so forth. But at the same time, we're worried about our allies because they're not democratic enough. And this is what's paralyzed, and it's going to paralyze John Kerry. It's finding allies who we can really embrace and bring to Congress and say, these are our people.
And who would those be? Do we know yet?
Well, that's the problem. We've got a hands-off relationship with Egypt right now because Sisi... Even though we sort of like him, we don't really like him. We're worried that he's going to go too far and be oppressive. The Saudis are our big allies, and yet we're worried. You know, the Saudi defense against ISIS, they just had a big TV program and brought a bunch of imams to condemn ISIS, which they did, and said that ISIS is against God and against Muhammad. And then the imam said ISIS is more kafir, more unbeliever than even Christians and Jews. And when you have... You know, I don't know whether that's supposed to calm the Western nerves or not. It only brings greater confessional extremism to the problem. And so we're worried about Saudi Arabia being too Salafist and too Islamist. At the same time, we want them to go fix this problem. And with Israel, our biggest ally in the region, just attacked Gaza, and we were quite fed up with sort of what seemed to be an extreme response without moving forward on a two-state solution, without curing the root problems of Palestinian malaise. And so we don't want to drag Israel into this either. We can't drag Israel into this. And so it shows you how difficult our options are. We can't ally with Iran. Most people in Washington do not want us to ally with Iran because we're trying to limit their nuclear capabilities. And yet, we are sort of allied with Iran in Baghdad, supporting pro-Iranian Shiite forces in Baghdad. So we've gotten ourselves, we don't like, this is the difficulty with trying to work with allies in the region, is we don't really have allies that we depend, that we can trust. And that leaves us carrying the bag alone. And so ultimately, this is the, I think, where Obama is frightened. And he says, if we go after ISIS, we're going to be doing it on our own. Mm. And then what's our answer for this big region, this empty, desolate, not empty, but this desolate region that's been so hurt by both Baghdad and by Damascus? How are we going to bring justice to that region?
Trudy, I do want to get to our callers. I'd be curious about your response to what Josh just said. I mean, do you think, in looking broadly at the region, is either we don't understand it particularly well, or it is so complicated that if we choose sides, we create all these other unintended consequences?
I think at this point in time, the Middle East is in such convulsions because of deep problems of identity and religious interpretation that we cannot remake it. I'm not advocating that. We've learned our lesson. But because it's going through convulsions, there are risks to the United States. And I don't think that just because it is so complicated, we can sit and do nothing while ISIS makes plans to not only destabilize allies, to conduct attacks in the West, and links up with other Islamist groups, becomes an inspiration for them, who may even, if Pakistan blows, get their hands on nuclear weapons. I don't think we can just sit there. So then the question becomes, what can we do counterterrorism-wise to disrupt and degrade? In countries where there's an ally on the ground to work with, like Iraq, maybe, partially, that's one thing. But Syria is another thing. We can't rebuild Sunnistan in Syria. But if we're just going to sit on our hands, ISIS is going to cause us deep problems, and I don't think we can just sit around waiting. That's what I'm saying.
Let me get Fred from Emmaus to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Fred. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, my name is Fred, and I'm a Gold Star dad. We lost our youngest son in Afghanistan in 2010. We have three more kids currently serving. One has already been into Afghanistan twice. And the idea that someone would get their head cut off doesn't seem to be, you know, seems to be driving the Americans crazy, except the fact that the Saudis beheaded four people 2 days ago for drug trafficking, and you can be beheaded for sorcery in Saudi Arabia. And we have, you know, 7,000 dead. We're 50 short of 19,000 or 20,000 being wounded in Afghanistan. We have 52,000 altogether, and everybody seems to be outraged about one person being killed on social media. Where were they for the last 12 years? And they're all, you know, the same people are killing them.
Fred, first of all, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and of course, we're so sorry about what happened to your son, and also appreciate the fact that so much of your family has been so willing to go and fight for this country. And you raise a really provocative question, and there is this social media that can drive a conversation. I have to say that we have done, or at least tried to do, our small part on Radio Times to make sure we interview lots of veterans and soldiers and Marines who have served in these two wars, so that we do not forget about their service and their sacrifice. But Josh, does he have a point?
He does have a point, and that is that there are deep cultural problems in the Middle East. As Trudy said, we can't fix Syria's identity problem. Obviously, we have to work on counterterrorism. But to underline the point that Fred, I think, just made, you know, Saudi Arabia has its own problems, but Syria, the ninth grade textbooks in Syria that are taught for religion class, and every public school student and private school student has to take religion class in Syria twice a week. The textbook for ninth grade has a section on pagans and atheists, and it says, how should Muslims deal with pagans and atheists? And the answer is that you have to convert them or kill them. Mm. They do not have freedom of thought. And it says that in the ninth grade textbook in Syria. This is a soi-disant secular state, but it's the Islamic answer. Now, that was not done in Syria. It was just in the textbook. But now that ISIS has overthrown the order in 30% of Syria and a big hunk of Iraq, it's following what was in the ninth grade textbook. And when they took over the Yazidis, who are pagans in their point of view, they decided, okay, we'll convert them. And if they won't convert, we're going to kill them, or we're going to chase them out. And that's why we saw this devastation of the Yazidi population. Now, all the other minorities, like the Alawites who are ruling Syria today, or the Ismailis or Druze, are also viewed as pagans in Islamic theology, because they deify Ali and they do other things that are called extremist responses to. So they're beyond the pale of religion. That's why they're clinging to power, and they're killing so many Sunnis rather than lose power, share power, give it away. And so I think that Fred is, he's making a point, which is, how do we even begin to fix this cultural problem? We can go in and bomb, but to sort of separate church and state and develop a national consciousness that supersedes the sectarian religious consciousness is a long-term project that only the Middle East can really undertake. And that's why Obama is, I think, treating this problem with great diffidence. He is being aggressive. He is going to use counterterrorism, but he doesn't want to get into nation building.
Fred, I do appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me add a tweet from Matthew, and I'll toss this to you, Trudy. Matthew says, why does it feel like we're constantly being reactionary rather than proactive in the Middle East? What is the end game? An interesting question. Do you think there's some truth to that from Matthew, that we are reactive, not proactive?
George W. Bush tried to be proactive. He went into Iraq, on the assumption that there might be, and intelligence was twisted to prove that there were nuclear weapons and terrorists and linked al-Qaeda and linked together. All right, so he was proactive. Obviously this carries its own risks, and they were huge. I think I understand fully that Obama came to office thinking, okay, we had done this for a long time, and it was time to focus on very real and serious problems at home. It is hard to be proactive. I can look back now, and I wrote at the time, I believe it would have been proactive to help moderate Syrian rebels. I can't prove that would have changed the outcome, because the Middle East is going through convulsions which were triggered by our getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Josh said, how do you get these different groups to live together? If you look back at Middle Eastern history, they lived together under the Ottoman Empire when you had one ruler overall, and they've lived together under dictators, under the Ba'ath Party in Syria and under the Ba'ath Party in Iraq. All the minorities lived together, and in cities, Sunnis and Shiites intermarried. Being proactive isn't easy, but are obvious. I think right now we have to be proactive in trying to, as best we can, put ISIS off balance, because I think they will plan terrorist attacks first against our allies, then against ourselves. But I don't say that this is something where you can simply find an easy formula.
We have a tweet from Rusty. This is for you, Josh. Rusty says, what makes Josh think ISIS doesn't have the capability to strike the United States? Been hearing things that have been stating the opposite of that. Josh?
Well, they say they are going to strike us. The leader, Baghdadi, was in an American jail for 3 years and clearly has a great animus against Americans. This was in Iraq. And now, so far, that will take months for them to plan it, and we have to be extremely vigilant and use our counterterrorist abilities. And those are immense. As we know, you know, the NSA is listening to all these phone calls out there, and they are working on this and trying to keep track of all the foreign fighters that are going there that might come back. And that's a constant problem. But America can, in a sense, fight this counterterrorism game. That's where our greatest strengths are. Our weakness is getting too involved in nation building in a region that doesn't want us to build their nation. And that would get us sucked in. It seems the entire Middle East, as Trudy has been saying, is going through this convulsion. They've had bad governance. They've grown too slowly with economic growth at 3 or 4%, while the population grows close to 3%. And there's a giant youth bulge. There's tons of unemployment. The sort of authoritarian bargain has broken down, where the authoritarian state created jobs, subsidized goods, and so forth. So the states are in shambles, and we're seeing them failing from one end of the Middle East to the other. And this is going to go on in Africa as well, where you have the same economic problems, youth bulge, unemployment, so forth. We are going to be going through this for decades to come. If we're going to take it seriously, we have to spend our money, and it's going to be expensive, to help economic development in the areas where there still is some hope for good governance, and try to work from those inwards rather than spending all of our money blowing things apart. And in areas like Syria, which are not the most important to America's strategic sort of long-term interests. But instead, in places like Egypt and Morocco, Jordan, where we do have hopes of building a proper and shoring up government, creating jobs and so forth. And we're going to have to look at this for 30, 40 years down the road. And it's going to be a world problem, because there are many countries that have done poorly in this great competition. China and BRIC companies, countries which we focused on, have been growing at 7, 8, 9%. They are pulling their poor people into the middle class at an extraordinary rate. But other countries are failing. And, you know, we have the Haitis and the Gazas, which have become wards of the international community. And that's what I think our big challenge is.
Well, Joshua Landis, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. We could go on. Thanks a lot. And Trudy Rubin, thank you for joining us as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the show. I'm Marty Moscone. Thanks for joining us. Stay with us for Hour 2.